This class was on, this whole course was on, it was called Death in the Realms of Existence. And at the time that I offered the course, Tibetan books on dying were very hot. And so I decided I had to put one out also. And so the book, the course had a few parts to it. One was a description of the various places you could go after you die, okay? And we'll talk about that. Another was a description of the bardo, meaning the time between the time you die and the time you're reborn, you know, what happens to you. And then I think at the end of the course, we did a death meditation, you know, how to do a death meditation. So we'll be going through all of those parts during this mini review. I'd like to talk first about, you know, the various places you can go after you die. This is one of the hardest parts of Buddhism for Americans to listen to, because we don't believe in future lives, and we instinctually don't believe in future lives. All of your newspapers, magazines, parents, school, churches, temples, whatever, they are informing you that there are no future lives, you know. Every TV advertisement for Budweiser says one life to live, drink up now. And, you know, and you think that's silly, but it actually is a small step towards brainwashing you to believe in your heart that that you do stop when you die. And I had people continuously, throughout my career as a Western Buddhist and a Western Buddhist teacher, I've been challenged to prove that there are future lives, you know. So I got tired of trying to prove them. We had a whole course on it, by the way, which we finished. Did we get to that yet? Yeah. Then I decided to turn the tables around. You know, you prove to me that your mind doesn't go on. You see what I mean? People would come up to me and say, prove that there's a future life. And I'd say, hey, you prove to me that there isn't. You know what I mean? And the only proof, and this was a proof that was debated back in India in 650 AD, is that your body stops moving. Okay, that's the only proof there is, that your mind stops. Mind and body are related, but not totally interdependent. You see what I mean? And so that just means that, for example, if a car breaks down on the highway, then the driver died. You see what I mean? Can you assume that if you see a car on the highway which is broken down, that the driver is no longer alive, who's sitting in the front seat? It's something like that. It's something that's as weak as that. And it sounds silly to you, but that's about the only proof they have in the West. And the rest is just what I call Mrs. Melvin. What's Mrs. Melvin? This is my first grade teacher, okay? And she told me that my mind stopped when I died, and I believed it, and I've believed it ever since, for no better reason than that, okay? When Jetsun Kapa's student was writing a book about future lives, he said, by the way, everybody in Tibet believes in future lives, but I haven't met a Tibetan who could tell me why there should be a future life. It's just there, Mrs. Melvin told them that there was future life. And they don't know why there is either. You see what I mean? And the basic thing is that your mind must go on, okay? The odds are something, okay? In your own mind, if you think about it, the odds are something that you go on, okay? What are the odds? You read this thing in Hamlet, right? He says, to be or not to be. And I used to think, you know, when I was a kid, to be or not to be what, you know? What is it? It's to be dead or not to be dead. You see what I mean? He's meaning, should I kill myself or not? He's having a debate with himself about whether to commit suicide. And then he goes through this beautiful soliloquy, and then at the end he says, yeah, I'll kill myself, and then maybe I'll start a dream, and uh-oh. Maybe the dream is worse than this. I won't commit suicide. You know, he decides that maybe the mind goes on. And he decides that what he knows is better than what he doesn't know about, and he decides not to kill himself. And that's exactly where your mind should be, okay? Like, yeah, maybe I can't prove to you in 5 minutes that you're going to go on, but hey, what are the odds that you can happen again if you happen once? It's 100%. Why? Because time is endless. Anything that can happen once in a zillion years can happen twice in 2 zillion years. You see what I mean? Time goes on. If you are sitting here once, in this realm, in this world, experiencing these things, do you think it can happen again? You know, don't call a bardo. Say it takes a million years, but you'll be here again. Your mind has to happen again. It will happen again. The odds that brought you here, the conditions that brought you here, will be repeated. Statistically, it's 100% odds. Because why? Because you happened once, and the space you're dealing with is infinity. So you can happen again. I mean, just statistically, you will happen again. Okay. So, how does it happen? Is New York City the only possible realm you can exist in? You know, I mean, what are the different realms there are? People tend to think in the smaller the town they grew up in, the Tibetans call it the frog and the whale syndrome. You know, the frog thinks that this well is the only possible body of water, and then somebody comes and explains the ocean to him, and he's like, ah, come on. Then somebody takes him out of the well and takes him to the edge of the ocean, and his brain blows up. Okay, that's the story of the frog and the well. You know, it's like, he just couldn't take it, you know. And everybody thinks that their own well is all there is. You know what I mean? And we have to talk a little bit about how you go to other realms, and then we'll talk about the other realms, okay? Those of you who know about the emptiness of the pen, which, you know, you're waiting for three-year retreats, so you don't have to hear about the pen, right? Okay. It's all the pen, okay? It's all the pen. Do you like the pen or not? Totally depends on you. It's not part of the pen. It's a projection or a perception on your part. It's not part of the pen to be likable or unlikable. It's only you. And everybody can accept that. On a deeper level, it's penness. The fact that that you perceive it as a pen is also coming from you. An animal comes here, they don't see it as a pen. An Eskimo comes here, who's never seen a pen, they don't see it as a pen. And then you do see it as a pen. That proves that there's no penness coming or emanating from this stick, okay? It's just whatever your mind forces you to see, okay? The same is true of every object around you, okay? The whole world around you. You recognize chairs from brown rectangles because of some karma you did in the past, and therefore you're able to use it as a chair and enjoy it as a chair. And the same for every single object in this room. Every time you recognize something, it's because your own mind is forcing you to do it in a certain way based on your past karma, based on what you did in the past. So like another kind of being, you know, like a dog can come in here. They see the same colors, they see the same shapes. They interpret it completely differently. For them, it's a totally different world. They don't see it as a chair. They don't cognize it as a chair. It has no use for them as a chair. You know, you have to get your butt on there and push it down. Your tail doesn't fit right. You know, they don't see it as a chair, you see? So when a dog comes in this same room and looks around, they see it totally different, you know? There's an interesting corner right down there where I could pee-pee, you know? That's really cool. And, you know, and they just see the room like that. They see it as a totally different thing. So it's easy to understand that based on their past karma, the dog and the human in this room are experiencing two different realms. There are two parallel realities going on in this room, okay, at least. And that's easy to understand. You don't have to be a philosopher to understand that. There's a dog's world and there's a human's world going on in this room at the same time when there's a dog in here. And they're totally in the same place, they have the same circumference, and there are two different beings having two different worlds in this room at the same time. That's easy to understand, okay? You can accept that easily. And by the way, when you teach this, please teach it this way. You know what I mean? If you say, you know, you hear Buddhist teachers that get up and say, oh, you're going to go to hell, there's a big box, you know, and they stuff you in the box and you're burned, and then people are like, come on. You know, it's not convincing. You know what I mean? It's not compelling. Because it's so foreign, and it's so hard to believe, you know. But this is easy to believe. Get it. There's a dog world going on in this room. There's a human world going on in this room. Do you think there can't be more than that? Do you think there can't be other kinds of beings who experience this realm in a different way? You see what I mean? It's very naive. It's frog in the well thinking to believe that there's only the two realms that you're aware of in this, even in this room. Okay, that's just naive to think that. That's what they call parochial, right? It's very small-minded. Of course, this room can be perceived in thousands of ways. Of course, therefore, there can be thousands of different creatures in this room at the same time. Some of them are visible to you, some of them are not. And how they experience this realm or this room is as foreign to you as how the dog experiences. When the dog walks in, really, they're only calculating three or four things. Where's a good place to pee-pee? You know, can anybody in this room give me some food? Is there another dog in this room? You know what I mean? They're just evaluating the room. Think about it. In very primitive terms, they only want three or four things out of this room. And that's how they see the room. And to think that there's not thousands of other ways to see the room is just naive. It's foolish, okay? So when you get reborn as a dog, it's not like there's a... I mean, when people talk to me about rebirth as a dog when I was a kid, I thought there must be a factory out in Omaha or something, like a secret government factory, and they're producing dog bodies, you know, like just carcasses. And then there's some guy that has a scalpel and opens up the back near the backbone, and then there's these spirits of dead people flying around the country, like from usually probably from the East Coast to the West Coast, and they stand there with big nets and they catch the spirits and they stuff them in the dog body and they sew it shut real tight, and then the dog becomes alive. You know, you think that, or at least you think in your mind there's a dog and your mind enters the dog, or your mind enters the body of your spirit, or mind enters the body of the dog. That's how you picture it in your mind, Dunji, right? Dachi, it's only you've heard about it, right? Never experienced it. That's what you think of when you think of being born as a dog. You think of there's already a dog body there, and then my mind somehow slips in and gets caught there, and I can't get out, or something like that, okay? That's completely wrong. That's not how it works, okay? You just start seeing things differently, and then you is a dog, okay? Get used to it. Get used to that. It's not like you become a dog and then you start to see the world differently. Your karma forces you to see your world differently, and that's what makes you a dog. Then you are a dog. Okay? You gotta get used to that. It's just a shift in your perceptions. To believe that there's some government conspiracy to catch spirits and put them into dog bodies is unreal. To say that my perceptions can shift radically within 5 minutes, and this doesn't look like an arm anymore, it looks like a leg of a dog, is the way it really works, okay? You know how much your perceptions are determining even the existence of this pen, okay? Your perceptions are making this pen exist, okay? You don't think the same thing applies to this cylinder that applies to this cylinder? Of course it does. How long does it take for the perceptions to shift? About the time it takes to die. How long is that? A couple minutes, okay? At any given time in your life, with a 10-minute shift, you'll be in a different realm. You'll be seeing this as something different, okay? And so the question of what are those other realms like? How many are there? What are the odds of going to each one? Which are better than others? How can I control the tulip, you know? That becomes a very important question if you understand the perception thing. Because of your perceptions are determining your reality, it's a very frightening and real prospect that at any moment in your life, 10 minutes from now, you could be in that realm. You could be a dog. Why? Because you're seeing things as a dog. Okay? Oh, that's just seeing things as a dog. Hey, that's what it is to be a dog. Get used to it. Okay? That's what it is to be a dog. You're only a human now because there's something in your mind forcing you to see these things as humanish things, and that karma is wearing out every time you have a thought. 65 in that much time. You just wore out 195 karma to see me as a human and you as a human. Okay? And you ain't got that many. And then one day they wear out, and what do we call that? Death. You use them up, okay? And there's a very limited supply in your mind. There's a very limited supply of karmic seeds that are producing this vision of a human realm like a film, like frames in a film. 65 going off every finger snap, and you're using them up like crazy. Okay, your karmic credit card is being blown as we speak. To spend an hour here to watch a person teach Dharma is the most expensive use of your karmic credit card. Okay, and by being here an hour, you've gotten 1 hour older, which means you've used up one more hour of karmic impressions in your mind. And they wear out. They wear out all at once. The karma, the impressions to see the clothes, the impressions to see the face, the arms, the chairs, New York City, they just go shoot, and then they're done like that. No, they just blink out. You wear out all at once, and we call that death. 5 minutes later, your perceptions are radically different. New karmic seeds are coming up. They could be anything. You don't know what's in your karmic pocket. Normally they're worse, okay? Much worse, okay? And you're just seeing things differently. People say, how come people don't remember their past lives? You have to appreciate the radical difference between your mind 5 minutes after you die and your mind now. You will be nothing like you are now. Nothing. You won't remember a thing. You know, all the things you struggled your whole life to collect, people, honors, you know, things, money, friends, family, you can't remember them 5 minutes after you died. There's these dim memories, these instincts, you know, I used to like ice cream, I don't remember, you know. I mean, you can't even think ice cream, okay? No, really. The very most powerful imprints created by a whole lifetime of a certain behavior will remain with you in a very dim way, a very murky way. And the rest is gone. You know, the whole conscious awareness of this plane of reality, it's just gone. And you don't remember much of it at all. How much of your dreams do you remember the next morning? How much of your dreams do you remember a week later? I mean, except for the very, very strong ones. And that's exactly the same. Jetsun Kapa, in many of his works on dream yoga, or, you know, it's very similar. You know, until the day that you can go into your dreams and study emptiness and meditate on it in a conscious way, as if it were your waking life, don't expect to be able to remember anything 10 minutes after you die. You see what I mean? You have to be on that level, which is very hard to get to, where you can walk around in your dreams, be as conscious in your dreams as you are now, do your practice in your dreams, meditate, study, recite things, think about emptiness, the hardest thing, right? Until you can really do that, you don't have much hope in the bottom of controlling what's going to be going on, okay? And how many people in this world, in their lifetime, achieve that kind of mastery over their dreams? The difference between your dream consciousness and your waking consciousness is very similar to the difference between your consciousness as you die and your consciousness 10 minutes after you die. If you can't control one, you have little odds of controlling the other. And you just won't remember. And you will be that other creature. And just the things that you spent most of your life on, there'll be some instincts imprinted on your mind. And the rest is all forgotten. Okay? So now it becomes a quite serious question of what are the other realms you can go to. At least we should know the possibilities. Okay? Did you have a question to me? Yeah. How do you spend karma? Karma is imprints from your subconscious floating up to your conscious world and coloring what you see, and more deeply creating what you see. And every time you see anything for any length of time, even a microsecond, you've just used up that impression. That impression has what we call ripened into the conscious mind, and then by experiencing it, you use it up. And then it's over. Okay? And every time you spend a minute on this plane of reality, you've used up something like, you know, what is this thing? 3,000 karmic imprints, you know? You can't grasp how expensive it is karmically to stay in this realm for a minute or an hour. You know, you take it for granted. But that's why people die so quickly, so easily. You know, and the older you get, the more it's just unreal. You know, I remember John F. Kennedy standing at his, in front of his father's casket, this cute little kid in his shorts and making this gesture. It seemed to be very natural, you know? And then think of his dad. It, just like that, you know what I mean? And to live here, to stay alive here is very hard, karmically. To stay alive in this realm is very, very, very expensive. And that's why people die quickly and suddenly, okay? And that's all. That's the process by which you use up karma. When you use up good karma, which, by the way, to be a human is to use up a lot of good karma. To come to a class is extremely expensive karma, okay? It's the most expensive karma, okay? And you use it up. Then there's a process by which only the bad karmas are left. You see what I mean? Oh, if you can spend bad karmas, it's great. Like one of the lojong or mental training practices is that, you know, if you're having a problem in your life, you know, you have someone at work you don't like, or you have a relationship that's not going well, or you feel sick or something like that, you should be happy that you're using up bad karma. You know, there's a state of mind where you take joy. Like, there's even a prayer that says, you know, may this problem go on so I can use up more bad karma and may it double and triple in the weeks to come. You know what I mean? So that's all. Yeah, you can use it up. Can you switch karmas and stuff like that? Definitely. We talked about it last week in the Friday night class. There's ways to short-circuit bad karmas. There's way to enhance good karmas. There's ways, and then ultimately the goal is to perpetuate the good karmas. There's a kind of, you know, fusion. Is it fusion or fission? I don't know. They're trying to reach this thing in atomic physics where a teaspoon of water could run New York City because it will run on itself. More energy out than you put in. And Buddhas are doing that. Buddhas have figured out karmically how to get one good deed to run a whole Buddha paradise and not wear out. And there's a process by which you do that. Okay, that's called a perfection. Okay. All right. So I'm going to review with you the possible realms which you can die and go to, but please don't think of it as dying and going to, right? Just a shift in your perceptions could happen as easily as the shift in perceptions from this room to the room out there when you go for refreshments. Remember, okay? The shift required to perceive this room and then follow that with the perception of that room is no less or no more, I don't know. Anyway, it's just as easy to have a shift from this human realm to an animal realm or worse, okay? It takes the same amount of time to go from this realm, this room to that lobby as it does to go from this whole realm to a different realm. Because it's just a shift in your perceptions. You don't walk from this room to that lobby. Your perceptions shift, okay? It's the Matrix all over again, okay? All right? Your karma, it's really a nice movie, you gotta see it. Okay? Your karma is feeding you data. It's actually, a lot of it is only going on in your mind. And you're perceiving, you interpret it as going from one room to another, but actually you're not moving in that sense. There's no independent person moving. There's a shift in your perceptions. Oh, well then that means nothing's real. Well, you go and take your perception out to the middle of 2nd Avenue, stand there in front of a perceived Pakistani taxi driver, and see if your perceived legs break, and you've got to go to a perceived hospital, and it hurts, okay? Yeah, it's all perceptions, but it's real. Get it? Okay? It's a reality which is created by your perceptions, and it hurts. That, you know, if it didn't hurt, everything would be okay, but it does. The fact that it's only perceptions is both your salvation and your doom, right? The fact that it's just perceptions means if you are nasty to the people around you and never get your act together as far as compassion, you will make things worse. Your perceptions will get worse and worse. Alternately, because everything is a perception, you have the opportunity to go to a tantric paradise in this lifetime. If you just work on your mind and on your vows, you know what I mean? You have both options are open to you because things are empty. Because things are just your perception. That's your salvation, and that's your, what's the opposite?
Damnation.
Yeah, okay. No, really. Everything's empty. If everything was fixed, we'd be in trouble. We'd just die, and didn't that be the idea that you just die and everything stops? But that's not the way reality works. Reality works because it's being produced by your perceptions. So if you take care to garden in your mind and plant nice karmic seeds by keeping your book, Tundru, 6 times a day, and you know, you do gardening, consciously gardening, putting the right things in your mental stream, so that a month later, 6 months later, a year later, your reality is improving. Okay, the fact that the movie Matrix came out, the fact that I could see it, the fact that, hundreds of thousands of people could watch a thing that's talking about the possibility that, you know, your mind is creating your reality, is in itself an extraordinary karma. It means we've been having good classes on emptiness. And I'm not kidding. The movie was produced from that. You got to get used to that. Okay? For us, the movie was produced by that. Okay? And more come out. It's weird. Truman's World and stuff like that. Okay? Anyway. All right. Yeah. Yeah, she said, I understand the thing that karma wears out and you perceive your death. But aren't you making new good karma all the time? That's true, but the odds are very, very lousy. You make one good karma for every 100,000 bad karmas, something like that. Okay? Seriously. In other words, the small, irritated states of mind throughout the day, which you can read on a person's face, you know, the very few people in the world who are collecting good karma faster than bad karma look like the Dalai Lama or something. You see what I mean? They are shining. And the rest of us are going around like... And you can read it on a person's face. You don't need to count their good karmas and their bad karmas. You know, the state of your face describes how your karma is being collected. And that's all. Most people are get older. Most people's faces get worse as they get older. This is a direct result of their thoughts, okay? Tantrically, you can explain it with the channels, and every time you have a small irritated thought in this room, a little more choking occurs at certain chakras, and then that affects specific areas of your face and your body. So actually, there's a physical basis for that. And if you are aging, what I mean to say, you are collecting bad karma much faster than good karma. Okay? It's just a fact. If you reverse that process, you would get younger. And the reason so few people are seen to do it is that very few people do it. Okay? Very few people do it. But tantric practice is the process of reversing that. And your body actually, in the end, it goes from not just younger, but it goes to a whole higher plane, physical plane. Your whole physical body transforms into some beautiful light, and then you're a tantric deity. So the whole idea is to reverse the trend. Extremely difficult and only possible if you understand how it works. See what I mean? Like, you can only get into trying to do it if you understand how you can do it. Somebody has to sit there and explain to you about the pen and all that, and then about the channels, and then you can say, oh, I get it. Now let me try. You see what I mean? It's we say knowledge can defeat everything. You know, all your millions of years of crappy mind can be overcome by a few years of pure knowledge. Okay? That's our hope. You know, that's our only hope, is that knowledge or wisdom, if you understand how this process works, then you can start to reverse it. And it works. And it's exciting when it starts. You know, you can observe it, things happening in your body and your mind and your life. And you can just sit there and sit back and watch the fireworks. It's very, very extraordinary. Very cool. Very cool process. Yeah?
Are all negative thoughts bad karma, negative karma?
She said, are all negative thoughts... Are all selfish thoughts bad karma? Yeah, basically, I can't think of one that...
So from the minute we wake up in the morning and want something for ourselves, this is 100,000.
Is it bad to want something for yourself? You got to be careful about that. Okay, you got to be careful about that. Buddhism says, want what you want for yourself, but never at the expense of others. Okay? If you want something for yourself, I want to get enlightened. I would like to have my body start reversing in the aging process. That's a pure thought. That's renunciation. That's close to bodhicitta. You see, I mean, we build on our own hopes, and those are reasonable hopes. You wouldn't be here if you didn't hope for something. You wouldn't be in the class if you didn't hope for something. So we say that's a virtue. Say, I want to get enlightened. You know, I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to die. I don't want to get old. You know, those are pure thoughts. There's no problem with that. Those are not selfish. Where it gets selfish is, and I'll do anything to anyone else to get it. You know, there's this scene, I saw Gone with the Wind. It's really long. And there's a scene halfway through, what's her name, picks up the dirt. Tara. And then she goes, I'll rebuild, what was the farm called? Oh, sorry. What's her name?
Scarlet.
Oh, Scarlet, yeah. So Scarlet like picks up and says, I'll rebuild Tara if I have to kill, lie, steal, you know, and, you know, and that, you know, it's not bad to want to rebuild Tara. That's a good thought. But then the next thought, you know, to steal, kill, burn, you know, that's a distinction. Buddhists have to want to be happy. You have to want to reach paradise. It's not selfish to want to do it. Bodhicitta means wanting to do that, and then on top of that, wanting to do it for other people. So no contradiction. It's very not a Christian idea. The Christian idea is, I mean, if I, the way it's been interpreted now, I don't think Christ would say that, but is that you can't want anything for yourself. It's wrong. You know what I mean? That's not, in Buddhism, you've got to want to be totally happy, and then when you get more mature, you want to be totally happy so you can teach other people how to do it. And that's all. And that's not a bad thing. But to do it at any expense of other people, which is what we do from the morning to the night, is that's bad karma. Yeah, yeah. It's the difference between intelligent desire and ignorant desire. Intelligent desire is something like bodhicitta. Okay, yeah. Good, it's a good question. Can beings in a lower realm, like insect realm, can they actively collect good karma? We say almost never. Which is why we say that you can't get out of those realms very easily. They tend to perpetuate themselves. Okay? Yeah, once you get down there, you stay for a long, 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 long time. Until you have an extraordinary life where you use up a hell of a lot of bad karma. And then there's one little tiny karma left from some smile you gave somebody in New York back in 1999, 1,000 years ago. And then that kicks you up to a higher realm. See what I mean? But normally, once you're down, you stay down for millions of years. Okay. Yeah, to come out, to come up is very brief, very unusual. They say in the scripture, said, "Tare tam shigyin," which means this is the only time I've ever come up out of the lower realms. And then there's all these commentaries. It's not technically true, you know. I've been up above before. And then they say, yeah, but why did Jetsun Kapa say this one and only time? You know, why does he say only one time that you ever got this kind of a body? He says, well, if you really count the odds, it's like one in jillions. So it might as well be one. You know what I mean? That's his answer. So anyway, you know, how to get out? We got to go to the realms. No? This is called the parking space theory. I shouldn't come to class because it's so expensive karmically. Okay, I should go to Starbucks. I mean, it's a lot of karma to drink an iced coffee, but I don't lose as many brownie, karmic brownie points as I do as if I go to class. And that's true. Okay, the theory, though, is that if you come to class, you learn how to make more. You see what I mean? So that's a fallacy. I had a friend who said, it's very hard to find a parking space in the East Village, you know, and he found this perfect one, and he's standing there, and he's looking at it, and he says, I'll leave it, you know. We'll keep driving around. And I'm like, why? And he says, I don't want to use up the good karma it would take. You know, and so that's a fallacy. Okay, that's a fallacy. If you end up not parking there, you didn't have the karma anyway. Get it? Okay. Anyway, here we go. There are, you know, when I talked about the direct perception of emptiness the other night, I forgot one big realization that you have. And that's that there really are three realms. You really are in a separate area of reality. There really are these things that are described in the Abhidharma about three different realms. You see that directly during what we call the aftermath, Jetob Yeshe, of the direct experience of emptiness. You understand directly that you do live in a thing called the desire realm. You do directly perceive that there are other realms. You do directly understand that this realm is defective, and that to be here, you have to be defective. Okay? The proof that any of us is defective is that we're here. Okay? If you're in this realm and you're not an emanation of an enlightened being or something like that, you are messed up. Okay? Your mind is messed up by definition. You know, you meet nice people, kind people, people you swear are different. Forget it. Anyone in the desire realm is about 0.5% apart. The nicest person in the desire realm and the worst person in the desire realm are in a very close to the same state of mind. Period. You know, you haven't ever met other beings. But if you get to this realm by means of karma and mental afflictions, then you are totally messed up. Unless you've seen emptiness directly or something like that. Okay, seriously. I mean, if you haven't reached that, you are a desire realm being. Your mind is chock full of mental afflictions. Your body is going to fall apart. Your life is going to fall apart. Every relationship you ever had is going to fall apart. This realm, to get here, you have to be bad. And to be here, you have to be bad. Okay, I don't want to make you feel bad or anything. Okay, but this is a realm of total suffering. And to get here, you have to be defective. And this realm doesn't work. It's like a broken car. The reason you're here is that you figured it out. Okay, it's just like a broken car. It doesn't work. It will never work. You can't fix it. This realm is a, what's that thing in the computer where they, it's the recycle bin. You know, I mean, this is where they dump all the mind streams that are not working very well. And you, if you're here, you're that kind of being. You perceive this right after you see emptiness, okay? You perceive this really is a defective realm. Everyone here is defective. The life here is defective. It's a waste. It's a joke. It's a sad joke. You know, there's a gimme ne in Tibetan means laughing, something to laugh, something to cry and laugh over. You know, nothing works here, and it can't work here. Your relationships, your job, your life, your body, you know, it can't. It doesn't work here. It's just broken. The realm is broken, and you got to get out of it, okay? And the only way is the Buddhist path, to get out of it, okay? Other traditions don't even tell you where you are. You know, there's a line in the Matrix. How's it go? It's a prison, Kino. You can't feel it, you can't see it, you can't taste it, and you're in it, you know. And that desire realm's like that. We are in the desire realm, okay? It's called Dukkham. The desire realm has basically 5 or 6 sections, sometimes taught as 20 sections. You can go over it in your breakout sessions, okay? I'm not going to go over it now. But basically, parallel 5 or 6 parallel realities going on at the same time. What? Animal way of seeing this place. Human way of seeing this place. And then a couple of other ways of seeing this place that you can't see them, but they're experiencing this place, okay? Like a hell realm. There's a very, very, you know, in my mind, unfortunate thing where some Tibetan teachers have been coming to America and say, oh, the hell realms are just a metaphor for a bad day. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, oh, there's not really any hot hell, there's not really any cold hell. It's just, hot hell means when you're having a bad day. Cold hell means when you're not friendly, or something like that. That's not true at all, okay? There are realms where people just burn, okay, all day. And someone in the Christian tradition saw it. and described it. You know what I mean? And that's why you have Dante and things like that. It's someone, somewhere, saw it. People struggle to say, oh, some Christian guy must have made it to India and then to Tibet, and that's why the Tibetans are talking about the same kind of health. It's not true. People in different parts of the world, in deep meditation, have seen, or in direct perception of these realms, they can see those realms, and they're describing them. You shouldn't think it like some historical weird thing that somebody in the Middle East and somebody in Tibet is describing the same hell realm. It's not a historical question. It's that certain people have entered deep states of prayer or meditation and seen these places and written down what they saw. And so I mean, it should almost act as a confirmation process for you that there do exist these places. And they're horrible. And they go on. The nature of those realms is that the perception of time slows down. You know, so what would be 5 minutes of pain here is hundreds of years there. You see what I mean? Because of the intensity of the pain, then the perception of time starts to slow down. So you could be there for 100 years, but it would feel like 10,000 years. You see what I mean? Of pain, like that. And they're under that all the time. Okay, they just live like that. They can't die. There's a thing about hell realms. You know, people stab you, cut your head, you know, cook you in something. You can't die. You don't have the capacity to die. It'd be all right to die. You can't. Okay? You keep regenerating your body. Okay? Then there's a sukham. Sukh means form. Sukham means form realm. It's given that name because the beings there have the most beautiful physical bodies of any of the beings who are still suffering. Okay? So they're still suffering, but they do have the most beautiful bodies. They live in some sort of like a temporary paradise. And then because they used up their credit card, they usually go to a hell realm after that. We consider reaching those temporary worldly paradises a big mistake. You get there by doing a meditation in which you sit and watch your breath and be calm for months and months and years, okay? You get to the form realm by doing this meditation because you haven't had the opportunity to do gross bad deeds because you're not lying and stealing and committing sexual misconduct because you're in a state of meditation, okay? And it feels great. You know, I saw the courses for watching your breath are booked for the next 6 months or a year or something. You know what I mean? It's a very pleasant experience. The only karmic result is to take you to a realm called the form realm, in which you live as a, some kind of a, on like a heroin state of mind for a long time, and then you always go to the hell realms after that. And so we consider it, in Buddhism, as Lord Buddha taught it, gross error, gross mistake, to watch your mind and try to turn off your thoughts, or to watch your thoughts move through your mind, or simply to only watch your breath as a practice. We consider it a grave mistake, grave error. And it's been taught that way throughout the history of Buddhism. Okay, people teaching that just haven't studied properly. Okay, it's very satisfying, it's very pleasant, and the results are very terrible. Karmically, dangerous. Okay, so you have to... That's how to get to the form realm. Okay? It's that kind of meditation. You have a temporary, very pleasant experience, and then you always go to a hell realm. Okay? Yeah?
Can you do good deeds in the form realm?
Can you do good deeds in other realms? They say desire realm is the best because you have a nice recipe of suffering and happiness. You see what I mean? Like, if you're in a hell realm, they say you can't do good deeds because you are just in total pain constantly. You can't have a generous thought towards someone else, okay? In the form realm, they say the opposite problem applies. You're too happy to want to do good deeds. You see what I mean? You're just having too much of a good time. It's supposed to be a really good time. So like, I remember a guy came into my class 10 years ago, and he was handsome and successful, and he had a good suit on, and I knew he was a movie actor, and I'm like, what's this guy doing in my class? Those people don't come to class. You know what I mean? Those people have receptions to go to and you know, more interesting things. You know, they're in big demand. People want to see them. Later I found out he had AIDS. He died with a couple of us standing around him, we took care of him, you know, as he died. And, you know, the form realm is like that. You're too happy. You're just too many things going right, so you don't think that you should practice. Okay, so those, generally it's very difficult to do good deeds in those realms. They don't think to. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Master Vasubandhu in the Abhidharma Kosha, which is the source of our text tonight, teaches breathing meditation only as a way to bring your mind to a state of calm so that you can move to a meaningful object. Okay? But in and of itself, if you don't take it any further, if it's just watching your breath to get a feeling of calmness, it's a drastic error. It's very dangerous. If you're able to do it well your whole life and die in some kind of deadened state of mind, you go to the form realm. And that's just another suffering. To see emptiness directly is 1,000 miles away from watching your breath. It's a totally different experience. We're aiming for that. And that takes hard study, hard practice, thinking your brains out, you know, sitting and meditating deeply for years, you know, and then you reach it. And that gets you out of this realm totally. But to sit and watch your breath is a serious mistake. Flatly, okay? And there's no basis for it in Buddhist scripture at all. Nowhere. In the traditional scriptures of India, okay? It was meant to be a warm-up in the first 5 minutes of your... Now, there are higher practices that depend on breathing practices. There are tantric practices that are deeply rooted in breathing, and that's a whole different story. That's a completely different story. Okay? All right. Yeah? I didn't catch you. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Quietude, meaning shamatha, is a perfect state of meditation. You can get it by studying baseball or soccer or music or anything else. It's a state of concentration. All great talented athletes have it. All very talented business people have it. Something very close to shamatha. Okay? It's a state of total concentration. Okay? Vipassana, which is vipassana in Sanskrit, is a state of understanding. It's a state of knowledge. The whole word has been misapplied. It doesn't have anything to do with the states of meditation. Nothing. Okay? It's described as a state of analytical wisdom which understands the emptiness of its object. It has nothing to do technically with breathing or meditation per se or like that. It's a totally different thing. It's just been the word has been misused accidentally for something totally different. Okay? Vipassana means a state of knowledge, which if linked with perfect concentration, allows you to see emptiness directly. Something like that. Okay? And a foe destroyer is a person who reaches the highest levels of that, overcomes their tendency to see things as self-existent, even in their most subtle form, and removes their mental afflictions forever. So foe destroyer and nirvana is the same thing. Okay? That's all. Desire that they overcome is ignorant desire, not knowledgeable desire. There's a huge distinction. Does the Dalai Lama desire to reach paradise? Of course. Does the Dalai Lama desire that you reach paradise? Of course. Is that something wrong? Of course not. Okay. What makes some desires right and some desires wrong? Okay. That's the whole key. If you undertake an action to acquire something without understanding the emptiness of the thing. Like, I can get a better pen if I go to a different store and pay more money. That's wrong desire. Okay? Now here's right desire. I can get a better pen and teach you all to have a better pen if I understand that the reason I'm seeing this pen is that I gave away pens in the past to other people. Now if you keep up that state of mind over an extended period of time, you're going to get your rear end into a tantric Buddha paradise. You see? Because that's knowledge. And that's not desire at all. That's a totally misconception. That's a complete misteaching. Okay? Should you want more pens? Of course. Are there pens in a Buddha paradise? If they needed them, they'd be there. Is it wrong to want to be in a Buddha paradise? Of course not. Is it wrong to want to get there yourself? No. Okay? Is it stupid? Yeah, I mean, you should do it for other people, but not at all. Not at all wrong to want to be there. That's not desire. Desire that you remove in Buddhism only refers to the kind which doesn't understand emptiness. Why? What's wrong with that desire? It don't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't get you what you want. If you have the kind of desire that says, I will take this pen and put it in here so other people can't get to it, that's just ignorant. That's the best way to lose your pen. Okay? That's stupid desire. That's the kind you get rid of in Buddhism. But to stand there and say, hey, the reason I'm seeing this thing tonight is because I was generous to other people in the past. And the reason I'm seeing it is that it's empty. Now, if it's empty, it means that I can see it over and over and over again if I totally release it and give it to anyone who needs it. And then the karma of that will be that I'll be forced to see them for the rest of my life. That's brilliant desire. And that all Buddhists should have. Okay, get used to it. Get used to it. And your heart tells you that. You don't want to go to some Buddha paradise where, oh no, I can't eat the ice cream, it would be selfish, you know. You know, that's not what paradise is about. When they paint paintings of paradise, they're not sitting there, you know, unhappy or... They're in a state of bliss, ecstasy. You know, they're having all the things you ever wanted at the same moment. They're getting ice cream ecstasy from every single object. You know, from every single object in the Buddha paradise. That's not selfish. That's the goal of Buddhism. You know, and then to teach other people how to do it. That's all. Now we gotta move on. Okay. By the way, the do and desire realm, you will treat in your breakout class. Okay. Why is it called desire realm? Maybe that's what's tripping you up. It's called desire realm because our realm runs on a desire for sense objects. Like most people in our realm are primarily interested in food and sex. And the first Dalai Lama explains that the desire and desire realm refers to that. Most people can't think farther than those two objects, and they will kill you. There's no future in that. It will kill you. It will certainly kill you. Are they bad, evil, undesirable? Not like that. You have to get to a point where you don't need them anymore. Your desires should be higher. You should work for something better. You know, you don't have to just get bliss from two things in the world. You could get bliss from everything. If you knew how to do it right, okay? And it's a lot cheaper and easier. Okay. Say, Sugmekam? Sugmekam? Sugmekam means the realm where people don't have any physical bodies. Okay, formless realm. In this case, meaning physical bodies. It's just a state where you can take a rebirth where you don't have a physical body. You just have the other four skandhas or heaps. You just basically... You are living in your mind. Okay? Where is the formless realm? It's wherever you died last time. Okay? Like if I died standing here, then my mind would enter the formless realm right here. Okay? Do they have a bardo? We say no. Why? The function of the bardo, or the state between death and rebirth, the function of that period is to make it from your current location to your next location. Okay? It's travel time. It's a subway thing. You have to get from one station to the other station. The whole bardo is defined by the time it takes you to get to your next rebirth. That's all. Sugmekam, when you enter the formless realm, you enter the formless realm wherever you happen to be standing. So there is no bardo. You just take immediate rebirth in the other realm. Okay, like that. So there is no place for the formless realm. Form realm is supposed to be somehow higher than the desire realm, and it depends on which geography you're in. Okay, I'm not going to talk about it. People make fun of Buddhist geography. They say, how naive. They thought there was a big mountain made of emerald and sapphire and other stuff, and there was these four continents, and I'm on Zamboling, and there's other ones. And that's how quaint that Vasubandhu thought that was how the world was, you know. If you understand emptiness, you don't have to apologize for the Buddhist presentation of the universe, okay? The idea that the moon is here, oh, out there at the end of the Apollo spaceship, and the Earth here, is just one more way to see the world. And 200, 300 years from now, they will consider that incredibly naive. And get used to that. Every few hundred years, somebody discovers a new way to look at the world. And the old ones are all dumb. Okay? It's all relative, okay? Get used to it. Don't think that in 70-something, I remember, that we finally figured out where the moon was or something like that. Don't even think like that. It's the same thing as this, okay? We are having a certain conception of the universe and the solar system right now, dependent on our past karma. 100 years from now, 500 years from now, people will surely have a different perception of the universe and the physical solar system and all that, okay? Don't be so naive as to think that we've finally discovered the ultimate answer as to where the planets are and stuff like that. They change depending on your perceptions every few hundred years, and people think there's progress, okay? Now, the Dalai Lama can't get up in front of 10,000 people at St. John's and say that, so he has to apologize. He has to say, well, you know, that was the old days, and of course those books are, that part of the Buddhist books is just old-fashioned, okay? He has to say that, okay? There's no time to explain emptiness to that many people. All right. We're getting short on time. Let me see if we have anything else. I think it would be, you know, it's tradition to go through the suffering of each of the realms now. We don't have time. Okay, you got a taste for the hell realms. And I don't want to go much more into it. I just want you to understand how, with a slight slip in your perceptions, you could be there 10 minutes from now. Okay? And I think you believe it. I think you understand it. If you understand the pen thing, then by implication, you understand the other thing. I don't have to go and try to prove hell to you. You already have all the theoretical basis you need to accept hell. What I'd like to do... Yeah. Wait a moment, okay? I'd like to do is go through the confirmable sufferings of our realm, of the human realm, very briefly, okay? I think when you teach Buddhism to your students in the future, you should emphasize these sufferings. I mean, these are the ones that you can see, taste, feel, the ones that you're undergoing now, and these are the ones that we can help people escape. Okay? So I think you should concentrate on them. I don't think, until your students are pretty sophisticated, that you should try to force on them hungry ghosts, hell realms. I've seen more people walk out of Buddhism on those issues than anything else. Don't push it at the beginning. Later you must go over it, because they will go there if you don't tell them about it, okay? But only when they're ready. You know, tantric teachings you're supposed to give only when people are ready. Emptiness teachings you're only supposed to give when people are ready. I would say the same in America about realm teachings. You see what I mean? Because you're just going to alienate people, I think, if you lay too much of this stuff on them. Oh, you're going to go to hell, there's a guy there with a big hook, you know, and people don't believe it, and then their whole perception of Buddhism goes down a notch. It's absolutely true that there are those places. You will go there if you don't take drastic steps now. You must teach people about them. But I'd say only when they're mentally ready for it. When they have some faith in you, trust in what you say, they understand something about perceptions and emptiness, then lead them into the discussion of the hell realms, because they must know about them. But I'd say be careful how you... Don't go to work tomorrow and lay hell realm teaching on somebody. they'll just ignore you after that. You see what I mean? You'll lose them. Okay. All right. Did you have a question? Okay. Yeah, good question. The three realms are all broken. The three realms are all defective. Whichever one you go into, it's the same story. Okay? Buddhas go outside of those three realms. They don't experience any of those three realms as their own reality ever after. Okay? High bodhisattvas would normally be coming back to the desire realm to finish off their work. Okay? So, if you've seen emptiness directly, for example, very typically, you will have seven rebirths in the desire realm, and you know it. You know where they're going to be, you know, in principle, you know where they're going to be, what they're going to be like, things like that. But normally, desire realm. Desire realm is the perfect realm for Buddhism. Just the right combination of suffering and hope. Just the right combination of renunciation and intellect. You see? It's a perfect realm for teaching Buddhism. And New York is like that, I think. People in New York are talented, sharp, and it's a very painful place to be sometimes. And so you have that perfect combination of talent and intellect and pain. And then between all three, people get Buddhism. You know, I think it's a perfect place to teach Buddhism. Okay. All right, here we go. People make fun of New York for all its bad parts, but I think on those three bases, it's a perfect place. You have a large population, they are intelligent, they are well-educated, and they are suffering greatly. So I think it's a beautiful opportunity for, you know, Chakrasambhara's mandala is supposedly a swipe mandala. He swiped it from an evil being, and he replaced all the minds of the beings there. They still have their old physical form, which like monsters. And they say the worse things get in the world, the more powerful his mandala works because of that ancient connection to evil. You see what I mean? So I take New York to be the same way. I think it's a beautiful it's a beautiful opportunity. You know, there's enough pain here, there's enough people here, and there's certainly enough intellect and talent in New York. You know, people are creative, intelligent. You know, I think it's a perfect place for teaching Buddhism in detail. Okay. All right, here we go. These are six sufferings of the human realm given by the first Panchen Lama. You heard it a few weeks ago if you were here at Friday night class. I'd like to repeat them in brief because I know we're getting late. And the sergeant hasn't even been waving at me. I don't know why. Say nghe me. Nghe me. Nghe me means literally nothing is certain, nothing is fixed. It has a very specific reference here. It's not just that things are uncertain in our life. That's not the point. The point is, especially in personal relationships, people can go 180 degrees around in about 3 weeks. And you've seen it, okay? The people that you were closest to, the people that you had the most faith in, the people that you felt the most love for, can switch 180 degrees in the space of a few weeks, become your worst enemy. There was a program where I grew up in Arizona where you could ride with the police so you could sympathize with them. And whenever I went with them a couple of times, and we were called to domestic violence scenes, and they would shake. The police would shake. They'd say, "This is the most dangerous by far." You know, like we would go to bars and stop gunfights and stuff. They didn't bother them. But the thought of going into a house with a husband and a wife going at it was frightening, because they said, "You never know what's going to happen. You know, there's the worst things happen in those places." These are people who love each other enough to vow, to swear on the Holy Bible that they would live together for better or for worse, blah, blah, blah. And there's something there that can make the whole thing twist around into the greatest hate of all. Okay? And that's the first suffering of our mind. This is the first suffering of our realm, the human realm, the worst suffering. Panchen Lama's six sufferings are not physical, they're mental. Okay? I think they're the most powerful of all sufferings. If I were going to teach Buddhism for only half an hour, I did it once in San Francisco, Santa Cruz, I think. And I didn't go through the six hell realms and blah, blah, blah. I went through these six, because these are much worse. The fact that the people you love in a few weeks can be the people you hate the most is one of our sufferings. Okay? Is it that they changed? No. What is it that makes you hate them so much later? Your credit card ran out. Okay? Get used to it. Okay? It's not your fault, really. It's not their fault, really. They are not an evil person. They're not someone who was a monster hiding behind this beautiful smile the first 3 weeks. It's not like that. Your karma wears out, and then you see them something different. And it will continue to happen over and over and over again in your personal relationships until you start practicing well. Until you start keeping your vows, until you understand emptiness, until you keep a book, you will continue to have this happen. Okay? You meet Dharma teachers, this thing called a honeymoon. You know, like a 9-month honeymoon with a Dharma teacher. Oh, I heard Michael Rose speak in Santa Cruz. I've been waiting. I'm going to move to New York, you know. Then they move to New York. 6 months later, they're like, I can't believe you're such a schmuck, you know. And now I see you for who you really are. That's how I really am, but this is your own karma. This is your own karma. The karma to see this sweet Dharma teacher wears out. It happens. It happens in all relationships. Your karma wears out, you see something different, okay? Unless you work really hard. And if you work really hard, it gets sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. But not because of the teacher, okay? Because of you. You're keeping your vows better and better and better. If you keep them very strong, they start to look more and more wonderful, okay? So really it's a decision for you to make, okay? All right, number two. Say, Ngomishe.
Ngomishe.
Ngomishe means that we are incapable of being contented. We are incapable of being satisfied. Okay. In a workplace, I did this, okay? I worked for a huge corporation. We started out with 2 people, 3 people. They offered me 7. I couldn't get a job. I went to 30 jewelry stores asking if I could work with diamonds. They threw me out. I went to this guy. He needed desperately someone who spoke English. He wanted to deal with huge companies. He didn't speak English. So he's like, I said, I will scrub the floors. I will clean the windows. I'll clean your shoes. Just let me work with diamonds, you know. And he's like, okay, $7 an hour. Princeton graduate, you know, presidential scholar, $7 an hour. What is the job? Carry the jewelry from 34th Street to 47th Street. Rain, snow, sleet, hot. Can't go on the subway because somebody will mug you. You know, you got diamonds and gold and you're like, got to look around you. And for years, in wool suit, you know, walking up and down. And so $7 an hour seems wonderful compared to 30 places that threw you out, you know. And then it's $15 an hour, then it's $20 an hour, then it's $25 an hour, then it's $20,000 a year, $30,000 a year, $50,000 a year, $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year. And you're never satisfied. Cannot be satisfied. Each time you get a raise, you're thinking about the next raise. Okay? It's just suffering. It's amazing that in a certain number of years, you can go from $7 an hour to the 100 and something, and you can't be satisfied. You know? You can't. Okay? We're incapable of being satisfied. It's the same in personal relationships. It's the same in Dharma teachings. Oh, can't believe he won't teach me that. You know, 7 years of free Dharma classes. Yeah, but I want that one, you know. You know what I mean? Yeah, you can study with me. Oh, thank you, you know. 6 weeks later. No, but I want to follow you around all the time. Okay. 6 weeks later. No, but I want to be in your room all the time. Okay. No, but I want to be on the couch with you all the time. You know, and it just, you can't satisfy it. You can't. It's just your mind. It's your mind setting one more impossible goal that you can't have. You know, it's just your mind. 6 months ago, you were happy to come to one lecture with 10,000 people there. You know, now you've got to be on the couch. You know, and, it's just your mind. Okay? It's just your mind. And at some point, you have to say, come on, that's enough. Okay? Okay. Say Yang Yang, Lundor. Yang Yang, Lundor. Yang Yang means over and over and over and over again. Lundor means give up your body, shed another body. Okay? Dora means the junk, throw out. Okay. The irony here, and it's very brief, is that you spend your whole life feeding one mouth, combing one head of hair, making sure one face looks okay in the morning, making sure one body has the nicest blouse or shirt or pants, you know, making sure one body has the nicest shoes, making sure one body doesn't get too hot or too cold or too thirsty or too hungry, ignoring all the other bodies in the world, basically. You know, once in a while you might offer someone some of your tea or something, okay? But mostly you're obsessed that this head of hair shouldn't be out of place. You know, you wouldn't want to go to class looking like Bob Chilton when he wakes up, you know? Okay? Like, you know, like at all costs, your hair must be all right. You're saying, and why? Why is your hair more important than the hair next to you? But you live like that, okay? Then, after spending all your attention on this particular body your entire life, how do you think you feel when you lose it? You know what I mean? When somebody says, hey, time to give it up, after thousands of hours of combing and washing and picking and plucking and smearing, you know, then naturally you're going to be incredibly attached to this body. And then when it's time to leave it, you're going to fight like hell, which is the worst thing to do as you die. Okay, so it's just get in the mood of, you know, I think it was Socrates who said every time you have a thought about food or something, you put one more chain between your spirit and your body. You know what I mean? And then when the body dies, you feel all this pain. You know what I mean? So the idea is to just start looking at it as a vehicle and not as something you're attached to. Okay. Number four. Say yang yang. Ning tam. Jor. Over and over again to have to take on new bodies. Okay? Take on new bodies. Ning tam jor means to take on a new body at the time of birth. Okay? Over and over again, you're shucking off old bodies, taking on new bodies. Okay? They say that if you dedicated one atom of dirt or molecule to your bodies that you've had and then put them all together, it would be larger than the planet. Larger than this planet. I think what's particularly useful is sometimes I go into 1 month retreats, I buy enough food for 1 month. You know how big that pile is? You know, I had like 4 carts full, and I went to this grocery store in Ireland and they said, go into the islands. You see, like that means you go camping on one of the islands and it's a month worth of food. And they said, this is not going to make it. You're not going to make it. This is not enough. You know, I'm like, come on, 4 carts, it's $500 of food, I can't make it? He said, no, you won't make it, that's not enough food, you know? And then imagine that times 12, times the number of years you've lived. I mean, they say in Buddhism, once in a while sit down and meditate on the mountain of food you've processed in your lifetime. You've chewed ton after ton after ton of food. You've pooped ton after ton after ton of food. And the number of bodies you've taken on, if you put them in a huge pile, it would just look like the Himalayas. It'd be larger. You know, just imagine sometimes dead bodies just stacked up, you know, like that. You can imagine it easier, I think, with the food you've eaten, that you've processed. Really, think about it. You know, it's disgusting in a way. Okay. All right. Two more and then we'll give you some more food. Say yang yang. Ho men. Jur. Yang yang means over and over again. To means big shot. Men means, what's the opposite? Small fry. Okay. Jur. To means high position, men means low position. Okay. Jur means you go back and forth, roller coaster. Your whole life is a big story like that. Okay? Like, I lived in corporate life for 16 years. There's no place better to watch it than that. You know, one bad board meeting and you're 3 levels down. You know, the boss has a good day with you, you're 3 levels up. You know, you can go from supervisor to VP to manager to schmuck in a year. And it's amazing. It's just extraordinary, you know, to see people. They had a saying in the diamond business. They said, be good to people on the way up because you meet them on the way down, you know. And I've really seen that happen. You know, it's this thing, and the diamond business is a pretty small business. I mean, there's only like so many diamond buyers in the world. And you have to be nice to everybody, because next week you might be working for them. You see what I mean? And that's the way it works. And then some people get into a big position and start abusing other people. And then inevitably they have to end up working for them. There's some kind of karmic thing there. It's not in the Wheel of Sharp Weapons, but I'm sure it should have been. You know, the people that you disrespect are the people that you end up having to work for later. And it just goes like that. Your whole life is like that. Okay, the karma to be the person in charge, the karma to be able to run your own life, the karma to be your own man is temporary. And then sooner or later you're working for somebody else. You have to do what they say. You don't like it. It's one of the great sufferings of life. Okay? And you go up and down constantly. You can't control it. You can leave that job, you'll be at another job, a worse job. Okay? Because the karma doesn't change when you leave your job. Okay? Last one. Say Drogme. Drogme. Drog means someone to accompany you, like a friend. And may means you don't have any, okay? And that's maybe the most painful suffering of life, is that ultimately you are alone. You are always alone, okay? Think of it as walking down Fifth Avenue, you meet someone for a while, and then they walk uptown and you walk downtown. And your whole life is like that, okay? You make temporary liaisons with other people, and then you move on your separate ways. And it will continue to be like that. It will always be like that. You are alone, okay? You come in alone, you go out alone. Temporarily, you hook up with somebody, and then karma will rip you apart, okay? You can't really share it with other people. You can't really go through life with someone else. Something, somebody, some karmic event will rip you apart. Ultimately, you're alone. And that's your condition in the desire realm. Okay, ultimately, no one can go with you, come with you. Okay, you can have relationships with somebody else. They are always temporary, and then you must go your separate ways. And it will always be like that. Okay, in the desire realm. Okay, somebody asked me in Australia, is there any way to get out of that? You know, and I said, yeah. If you follow your vows carefully, if you keep your commitments properly, if you collect only good karma, then you can be with other people forever. Okay? I mean, that's one of the incentives, I think, for Buddhahood. Yeah. You work with the person you like or someone that you're close to. If you work on your vows, keep your vows purely, reach your goals, you can help each other reach your goals. Then there was a joke in Australia that said, oh, it'd be like Mr. and Mrs. Chakrasambhara. And I said, yeah, it would be like that. Okay? You can do that. That's possible. But it would be really hard work. Really, really hard work, okay? So it's possible to overcome each of these sufferings. You don't have to live like that. These are sufferings of this broken realm, and you don't have to stay here. If you get to another realm, they work differently, okay? They don't work on karmic credit cards. They work on karmic fusion. Less karma in, more pleasure out, okay? And they feed. They get bigger and bigger. Okay, that's the whole point. That's the whole goal. These six sufferings are not inevitable. The opposites are achievable. You just have to understand the Buddhist path, and then you have to follow it with your book and other practices. Okay, take a break, and then we'll go into our things. Eventually, we'd like to have a crew of our people there teaching Buddhism. They want us there. They're asking us to come. They're begging us to send students there. American students like you, they want you there. And hundreds and hundreds of people want to study. And they want to learn English while they study Buddhism. So that's their goal, is that, okay? So, if you can help, it'd be nice. If you go, then you'll get to know them and you'll probably want to do it, I think. It's a beautiful place, pristine country. Maybe one of the last in the world, I think, okay? All right. I'm just finishing my book, okay? Okay, very, very brief tonight, and then we'll go. the function or the purpose of this series of talks has been to talk about the future of Buddhism in America. And then my Australian students say, why not Australia too? But anyway, in the West, okay? I just want to talk for 1 minute about the goals of Buddhism. You know, we've talked a lot about how to keep your finances, what books to teach, how to do certain teachings, blah, 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 all these things. I think it'd be worth it just to talk for 1 minute about the goal of having a Dharma center or a Dharma organization. You know, why are we having these classes? You know, why does this organization exist? Okay? And I think it's easy to get distracted by lower goals, like sometimes you're concerned about how many people come to class, or you're concerned about whether or not people can speak Tibetan language or recite things in Tibetan. Sometimes you're concerned about, do you know the four thises, the three thats, and the five thats? Someone told me the homework, the quiz for tonight was four fours, three threes, and one five, or something like that. But, you know what I mean? And if you get those, will it somehow make you a better person, or make you feel better, or something like that, you know? What is the goal of these classes? And just very briefly, you know, what is the reason to exist as an organization? What's the reason to have classes? Why even start Buddhist Path? Why do meditation? Why think at all about Buddhism? What is your goal? You know, and I think it's easy to get distracted by lesser goals, like, is your organization going well as an organization? Does everybody know their prayers? You know, do you feel good at the place? You know, I mean, is there a nice community feeling or something like that? Is your breathing going smoothly? I mean, these are goals in various places. And by the way, I don't mean to disparage the breathing practice. It's a very holy, sacred practice taught by Master Vasubandhu and other people. But it's not enough by itself. That's all I'm saying. And then, you know, in some places, you feel good if you're doing community service. You know, if the organization is feeding poor people or doing something like that, then what is the goal? You know, what do we really want? And I think it's important on an organizational level. I think it's important on a national level. What is Buddhism in America supposed to happen? What's supposed to happen? If Buddhism became successful in America, what would happen? What do you want? You know, do you just want to have a religion, or what do you want? You see what I mean? And do you want to have more people than other religions, or what's the goal? You know, I think it's very, very important on a personal level, national level, city level, that each Dharma organization keep in mind the only goal, which is each person as an individual doing their practice, understanding the main ideas of Buddhism, and then actually achieving their own spiritual goals. You know, and it seems to go without saying that that's what we would be here for. But then you tend to get distracted by other things. You know what I mean? So all I wanted to say was that we have to keep in mind the goal. A, try to see emptiness directly. Period. B, you know, try to get to a state of real compassion where you really care about other people. You really love other people for the right reason. You see what I mean? To help them reach ultimate goals, and not just to feed them or to clothe them or things like that. That would be the reason for existing. And then finally, to reach enlightenment. And I believe that I have a personal feeling that when I go around the country and around the world, people are constantly coming to me and saying, you make it sound like we could actually do this in one lifetime. You know, you make it sound like I could change into a tantric deity in the next few years. You know, nobody ever says that. Are you sure this is not just Michael Roche's version of Buddhism, you know? And it's not, okay? And that's the goal of Buddhism, is to, you know, I get nervous when I talk about, hey, you could reverse the aging process. You don't have to get old. You don't have to die. That's not true. And then I'm like looking around if anyone's going to raise their hand. You know, I get nervous, you know. It's absolutely the truth, and it's the only reason we're here. And get used to it, you know. Think about it. We're here to overcome death itself. And you're here to actually reverse the process of aging. And you're here to reach a totally perfect, enlightened realm and body and mind in the next few years. Period. That's what we exist for. That's what we are doing. You know what I mean? And just keep that in mind. That's all. Okay, that's what we're here for. And nothing less than that. The other things are nice. It's nice to have refreshments. It's nice to talk with each other. You know, it's nice to have a community. It's nice to help other people in a physical way. It's important. But the goal is that. And don't ever let somebody sell you Buddhism for less than that. Okay? You're here to reverse the mistakes of the desire realm. And to get out. And to actually become a different creature altogether. And keep that in mind all the time when you're studying, when you're doing your quizzes, these boring, stupid quizzes and homeworks. It's all aimed at that. And as you teach your own students and begin to attract your own students, don't sell them less than that. And don't be shy to talk about it. You know, that's the goal. That's the real goal. Totally achievable by each person in this room. We have the information. We have the data. You know, all the method is there. You know, you just have to have the courage to practice it, you know, and the vision. And don't be satisfied with something less than that, you know. Don't be satisfied with going to class because you met somebody there that you like or something like that. You're here for one reason, to change your body into that of an enlightened being and your mind, and to reach a sacred enlightened realm in this lifetime. And you can do it. We have all the practices you need. But you've got to have your mind on that all the time, or it becomes something less than what it is. Okay? That's all. We'll do a short prayer. Thanks for coming. I know it's very uncomfortable in New York at this few months, and I admire that you actually come and work so hard, and I thank you for that. Okay?